from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Unarmed black teenager Michael Brown was shot to death over the weekend in Ferguson, Missouri, by a local police officer. The police said there was a struggle for the officer's weapon. A friend and witness says Brown was walking down the street with his hands up and was shot. In the aftermath, protest and rage in Ferguson and hard questions nationwide over police use of deadly force. In New York, where we all saw the chokehold killing on video. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, where the federal government was called in to address a pattern of excessive force. This hour On Point, the Ferguson killing beyond and police use of deadly force. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's going on? Is this about race, poverty, racism, community safety? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from St. Louis is Rachel Lippman, crime and justice reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. She's their lead reporter on the shooting death of Michael Brown. Rachel Lippman, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
What is the latest on the investigation of the killing itself? Is any more known at this point about what actually happened on Saturday?
Nothing more is known officially at this point, Tom. As you mentioned, there's two competing narratives. One, the official narrative from the St. Louis County Police, who are handling the investigation rather than the Ferguson Department itself. And that is, as you mentioned, that there was a struggle for the gun, that a shot was fired inside the car. And then there is the one eyewitness you mentioned, and I believe a second eyewitness now that the NAACP has identified, telling a much different story, that Mike Brown was in more of a, I'm running away with my hands up, and he was shot. We do know he was shot multiple times. We don't know how many. And right now, the St. Louis County will not be releasing the autopsy report or the name of the Ferguson officer.
St. Louis County Police have stepped in for a more independent view of what's going on. Here was their police chief, John Belmar, describing the shooting. This was on Sunday.
There were shell casings recovered. The shell casings are all matched to one weapon. That's the officer's weapon. There were more than a few shell casings recovered. I cannot say at this time how many times the subject was struck by gunfire. It's hard to know. It was more than just a couple, but I don't think it was many more than that.
And here are protesters with their hands up in the air saying, "Hands up, don't shoot," facing off with the police on Monday over the death of Michael Brown.
Hands up, don't shoot!
Hands up, don't shoot!
Hands up,
don't shoot!
Rachel Lippman with St. Louis Public Radio. So who all is investigating now? The St. Louis County Police up above the Ferguson Police are looking in here. The FBI is involved too, Rachel.
That is correct. The St. Louis County Police, or the Ferguson Police Department, immediately turned over the investigation to the St. Louis County Police in order to make it as impartial as they could. It's important to note, though, that not many people trust the St. Louis County Police either. They've been a presence out in the strongest fashion in some of these riots and some of the aftermath. The FBI is also investigating the shooting at the request of Attorney General Eric Holder. There's been a request from some prominent African-American congressmen, both from the St. Louis area and elsewhere, for the FBI to broaden its investigation, not just into this particular shooting, but into sort of systemic racial profiling problems in the Ferguson Police Department.
Talk about the response to what has happened. I mean, there have been a lot of people in the streets, and there's several strands to this. Some quite focused, deliberate citizen protest over police behavior, but then some kind of off-the-hook looting, rioting. What's going on?
The protests themselves have been boisterous but peaceful. There have been arrests made when individuals have refused to clear at the request of the police officers, but there's been no violence occurring at those protests. And it is important to note that the rally and march and candlelight vigil that led up to the flashpoint on Sunday were also peaceful. Most of those marchers had returned back into the housing complex where this took place when a small group approached police lines on Sunday night and began throwing bottles, rocks, anything they could at the police officers who were there to make sure that they didn't sort of go beyond a certain point on a main street in Ferguson.
Here's a little sound of Monica Timmons. She talked with NPR on Monday during one of these protests, demanding the identity of the police officer responsible for the shooting of Michael Brown. The police department, they're not releasing that so far. And Monica Timmons here looking at a bigger problem.
I don't have kids, and this is why. I do not want to be scared to have a son in America. Like, ain't you scared to have one? You know, like, let's be real. You know, What do our sons got to look forward to? You want to bring a son to this so he can get killed? No.
Monica Timmons in Ferguson, Missouri. Rachel Lippman, what are the demographics and the politics of this town that have set up so much tension that we've seen come to the surface since Michael Brown's killing?
Ferguson is a town that is about two-thirds African-American. The area where this shooting took place, the initial shooting of Michael Brown took place, is a neighborhood that has a lot of Section 8 apartments back there. The police force is almost all white. I think of about 50, 51 sworn officers. There are only three that are African-American. The mayor of the town is also white, though he says he grew up here and has never had a problem or seen a problem with race in the area, that he's always been fine with it.
This was a largely white suburb not so long ago. That's changed. Is that why the police department is still so heavily white? 50, I think I read, out of 53 officers?
I would think that's probably part of the reason. The mayor, when we spoke to him earlier this week, also said that it's like there is in any field. As he pointed out, it's not been that long ago since African Americans were even prevented from having jobs on the police force or in city management or in construction or in a whole bunch of different fields. And he said it's taken longer than he would like to get some of these get African Americans integrated into some of these areas: city management, police, construction, etc.
And what is expected from the investigation? When might we have a clearer, confirmed sense, if we can, of what happened in Michael Brown's death?
There's no sense right now as to what's happening. From what I understand from the county police, it was a fairly complicated scene to do. They still have ballistics testing to do. They're trying to track down or speak to in person the eyewitness who's given several interviews on television, both national and local. As I understand it, he's got warrants out for his arrest for unrelated crimes, maybe part of the reason he is reluctant to speak to the police.
Is there a history of police excessive violence in Ferguson that residents point to?
Residents won't necessarily point to excessive violence, but they'll point to just sort of everyday harassment. As you heard Monica Timmons say, it's the general driving while black, walking while black. They feel like they always have to be on edge. And this is not uncommon in areas even in the city of St. Louis and some of the other suburbs, that they just don't feel comfortable being African-American in some of these areas. And another protester made a very interesting point as well when I was speaking to him. He said the militarization and the heavy police response may actually be making the situation worse. It's getting people more and more afraid, kind of proving their point that they should be afraid of the police. That the police are responding disproportionately to what have been, for the most part, peaceful protests.
And all this coming after we've seen other incidents. The chokehold case in New York, Albuquerque with its own very tough record on police violence and beyond. Rachel Lippman has joined us from St. Louis, Missouri, justice and crime and justice reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Rachel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Here's one protester again in Ferguson, Missouri, over the weekend following the shooting of Michael Brown, talking with Fox News.
You took that from him. Y'all got his blood on y'all hands.
Blood on your hands. And here at a press conference on the steps of the St. Louis courthouse on Tuesday, Michael Brown Sr., father of the shooting victim, Michael Brown Jr.
But I need all of us to come together and do this right, the right way.
Yeah.
The right way so we can get something done about this. No violence, man.
With us right now from St. Louis, Daniel Isom. He's the former St. Louis chief of police. He's now professor of policing in the community in the development of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Daniel Isom, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
What's gone wrong here?
Well, certainly all of us should be concerned when a fairly low-level contact with an officer and a citizen turns deadly. And so many people are asking the question, how did this happen and why did it happen? I think on a deeper level, there are some issues that have been simmering in the community for some time, and the protest and the outburst or manifestation of some of these deeper issues, certainly Mike Brown was the flashpoint for those frustrations.
Talk about those issues. This isn't the first town or city in which we've seen this arise. People were shocked at the chokehold video death that came out of New York. Albuquerque has had the federal government in there, having to get on top of what was a very large death rate in police shootings there and beyond. Where are things going off the straight and narrow here, if they are?
Well, you know, These are incidents where I think from the policing profession, we really need to review and think about what are our tactics when we deal with passive resistance and relatively minor encounters with police. You do have the luxury of time. You do have the luxury of distance. You can be a little bit more patient in these cases and hopefully try to resolve them through dialogue as opposed to force. Certainly everyone understands if an officer is responding to a armed robbery, a shooting, or homicide, there's going to be a heightened urgency in, you know, securing the scene, using force, immediately arresting that person. But it appears in some of these cases that dialogue and patience was not the tactic that was used. And so a relatively low and minor encounter turned deadly. And so I think we have to kind of review from a policing standpoint, how do we deal with situations like this so they do not turn deadly?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American police and deadly force in Ferguson, Missouri, in the headlines right now. In New York, the chokehold case there that got so much attention. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, where there's been a long-standing issue, the federal government's come in there. We're asking, what is going on? You can join us. How do you see the latest case in Ferguson? Have some of our police become too aggressive, too ready to shoot? Is this about tension in the streets? Is it about fear? Is it about community safety? Is it about race, racism? In Ferguson, on Monday, police used tear gas to disperse protesters and looters after a rally supporting Michael Brown turned violent. Here's video from RT. But it's not just there. In July, protesters gathered at a rally for Eric Garner, who died after a police officer in New York, Staten Island, put him in a chokehold. And here, protests in Albuquerque after the shooting death of mentally ill James Boyd in March by police.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, killer cops have got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, killer cops have got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, killer cops.
We're looking at what's going on here. Daniel Isom is with us. He's a former St. Louis chief of police. Daniel Isom, you must have a pretty good sense of Ferguson, Missouri. How do you read the sort of the cultural profile, the relationship between police and residents there that may have set the stage for what happened?
Well, Ferguson is a small suburban community just outside the city of St. Louis. And as some of your earlier guests have pointed out, it was an area that has transitioned from predominantly white to predominantly black over the course of probably 25 or 30 years. It's not a particularly very high crime neighborhood, although they do experience some violent crime in that area. But the police force is predominantly white. And according to residents, there has been an over-policing of that community, and people are frustrated with the stops and the presence of police officers in their neighborhood. Now, this is not uncommon for urban and inner suburban ring communities in the United States, this tension that exists between the police and communities. But it is an issue that police departments must constantly work on, and diversity is one way in which you can help to bridge that gap between the police and the community.
We're trying to figure out what could have happened here. He was headed off to college in a day or two. He was walking home with a friend from a convenience store, 18 years old. Here's a little bit of an interview that friend, Dorian Johnson, who was an eyewitness, friend of Michael Brown, talked to MSNBC. Chris Hayes on Monday said that Michael Brown did not touch, he said, the officer who shot him.
Did Michael at any point strike out, lay hands on, assault the officer?
He did not initially assault the officer. I didn't see it at no point in time while I was standing in the officer's driver door window where he touched the officer in any type of threatening way.
So can you picture what could have happened that might have justified a shooting like this, Daniel Isom, or does it look necessarily like policing gone wrong?
Well, I think what we do know is that something did go wrong, and terribly wrong, because we must take the reason for the initial encounter and use that as the starting point.
Okay.
So if in fact it is true that the only reason that he was stopped was because he was walking in the middle of the street, we would hope that that would not escalate into a deadly encounter. Now, what happened between the officer having contact with him and Michael Brown being killed is the question, and it's a big question. And depending on what comes out in the investigation, there is going to have to be some accountability for actions that happen in that case. You know, is it a scenario where it could be justified? Yes. But there are certainly many scenarios where it wouldn't be justified at all. And for right now, looking at the genesis of the case, meaning that he wasn't even stopped for what would be a very significant crime, if a crime at all, then we have to say is deeply troubling.
And the young man ends up dead. St. Louis has a significant African-American population, has for a long time. Ferguson has a significant African-American population. You're African-American. You lived the life in this city. Do you imagine that race was a part of what happened here?
But I don't know that race is necessarily a part of what happened here. But what I do know is that in many cities across America, and I think this is the frustration that's simmering, it's a fact that young African-American males are disproportionately involved in criminal activity in America. And because of that, there is a disproportionate amount of contact with police. And many in the community would say that there is a hypersensitivity to African-American young males as being threatening. And if that is the case, which it probably is the case, I think if we're all being honest about it, then are those groups of people exposed to way more contact than any other group in America? And I'd have to say probably yes. And so would you be frustrated if as a result of that, you had contacts with the police on a regular basis? And so I think that's the real question, is that how do we deal with these biases that we have in policing and in America in general? Mm. And what are manifestations of that in terms of both police interaction with young black males and young black males' interaction with police?
We don't know yet exactly what happened in Ferguson. We do know, or have a pretty good idea, what happened in New York in the case of Eric Garner. There was video. I want to play just a little bit and get your response to this one, because these have come in succession here. This is some of the video of Eric Garner during his confrontation. This video has been all over the place. This was with police on July 17th. Where he was selling cigarettes, onesies, on the street in Staten Island. Big guy, asthma problems, we learned later. Medical examiner said the cause of death was a homicide caused by chokehold. This is very troubling tape here, so brace yourself. Be forewarned. It's disturbing, but this is the sound of Eric Garner in a police chokehold.
Put your hand behind your back. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
Daniel Isom is former St. Louis chief of police. As a police officer, what did you see? It was so deeply troubling. It seemed unnecessary. And a civilian looks on and says, why so much force?
Well, it goes back to my earlier comment. In the Garner case, certainly he was being stopped for what they thought was a violation, and they were going to take him into custody.
But he was selling, cigarettes in an illegal way. That's hardly a capital case.
Hardly a capital case. And so what should be your response? He was really in a passive resistance mode, right? Mm-hmm. He wasn't physically fighting the officers. You know, they surrounded him, cornered him off. Did they have the luxury of time in this situation to use more diplomacy? And some people would say, well, officers don't need to use diplomacy. Well, in a passive resistance case, you do have the time to and the ability to talk a person down, to get them to comply willingly. And usually that's what you want to do. So they make the decision to move in. From a tactical standpoint and from a use of tactic standpoint, a couple of things, and I think the police chief in New York even spoke about this, is that a chokehold is a deadly force maneuver. We teach officers that when you use a chokehold, if you're using it, it's because you have a deadly force encounter. So that's one problem. The second issue is positional asphyxiation. We teach officers not to put people in the prone position and kneel on their back or stand on them. And in this case, you had several officers who had him in a prone position and were laying on him in addition to the chokehold. So from a training and tactical standpoint, all of that was all wrong. And it was exacerbated by the fact that he had respiratory problems. So so a number of issues there in that case. But it goes back to the fact that how quickly do we have to use force when, as you stated, this is hardly a capital crime?
Eric Garner was black. The officers were not. Race is not always an issue. I mean, here's a piece out of the Albuquerque story. Again, very troubling tape here, so be forewarned. But this is a clip of Albuquerque police shooting and killing 38-year-old James Boyd. This is in March of this year. Albuquerque citizens came out into the streets also in protest after this over police violence. Boyd was mentally ill, and he was illegally camping in the hills of the city. You can hear his last words, "Please don't hurt me. I can't move."
Still got the knives in his hand.
Stepping up behind you. You moving?
Please don't hurt me.
His hands still armed.
Yep. Move.
Get your hands out.
Drop
the knife.
Lean back. Right behind you.
Put your hands out to your side and drop the knife. Hands out to your side.
Beanbag.
Drop the knife.
Video bringing us some of that. The federal government involved in Albuquerque, where the number of police killings was just too much for local residents to deal with. Daniel Isom, former St. Louis police chief, is with us. Steve Zeidman joins us right now from New York. He's director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at the CUNY School of Law, City University of New York. He was a member of the Mayor's Advisory Committee for the Judiciary in the Bloomberg and Giuliani administrations. Wrote an essay called "Is Broken Windows Broken?" Yes, in New York Daily News. The broken windows theory said, come in, enforce order in a very meticulous way, and you'll end up with less crime. Steve Zeidman's been asking if we've taken that too far. Steve Zeidman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Do we have a problem with American police going overboard in general on enforcing order, even over small infractions, and in particular when it comes to deadly force?
Yeah, I think these three cases that you're talking about today flag the issue very clearly. If you just take them one at a time, Michael Brown, what seems to have started this homicide was he was walking in the middle of the street. James Boyd was illegally camping, and Eric Garner was allegedly selling loose cigarettes. And we have three homicides as a result. And I think it forces the country to recognize that different neighborhoods, different police are being policed differently. And in particular, New York City, with this idea of broken windows policing, quality of life policing, you unleash police officers into certain zip codes, primarily black and Latino neighborhoods, with a mandate to maintain order, and it's a recipe for disaster.
But, I mean, order is required, but if you try to be so meticulous, and in a period when crime has generally been down, you're saying it sets police up to go too far.
Sure. I mean, think about it. In New York City, for example, we have 34,000 police officers. That's an awful lot of people. And when an individual officer is dispatched into a particular neighborhood, the marching orders that day, whether it's a quota or not, is just think about this. It's maintain order. And there is so much discretion as part of that directive. So what do we mean by maintain order? Well, in New York City, we have people being arrested for riding a bike on the sidewalk, for drinking a beer on their stoop, for taking up two seats on the subway, for talking with friends on a street corner. And you have to wonder, and at a minimum, it's going to create friction and tension between the police and the community. I think at a maximum, it's going to create hostility and antagonism. And obviously, in situations like Eric Garner, it creates an absolute tragedy.
For a long time, people looked at this broken windows approach and said, hey, it's great. We've got more orderly cities. Crime is way down. This is beautiful.
In particular, those folks who aren't affected by the broken windows arrests. Mm-hmm. You know, what's been remarkable, what we've been learning more and more, is who bears the brunt of this strategy of policing. And the numbers are close to 90% of the people who get arrested for these quality of life, incredibly trivial offenses, are people of color.
Let's go to our callers. Lee in Dayton, Ohio. Lee, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I was talking to one of your people earlier about an incident that happened at Walmart. Dayton, Ohio is where I live. Walmart is in Beaver Creek, right outside of Dayton.
Okay.
Still in Montgomery County.
Yep.
Incident happened Wednesday of this month, last Wednesday of this month. Young man was 22 in a Walmart with his girlfriend, walking around, playing, joking around, and he got a phone call on his cell. He walked away from her, as she says on the news, and the phone call was from his mom while he was talking to her. I guess he picked up some toy gun or fake gun, and people in the store decided to say that he was aiming it at people and loading it. But the thing about it is, if you even get a pellet gun in any given store, you can't walk out of the sports department without it.
So what happened there, Lee? What happened?
The young man supposedly had the gun, and they called local authorities, police rushed in. Excuse me. Beaver Creek police rushed in and was yelling at the guy to drop the weapon. And
it was a toy gun, you say?
Yes, and he was telling him that the gun was not real. His mom was hearing this. And the next thing, I guess he obviously probably held it up, showing that it's not real, and they put two shots in him, and he went down, died from it.
Wow. Wow, I don't have that all in news story form, but the way you tell it, Lee, one can picture it, and again, it's disturbing. I appreciate your call. Dylan in Nashville, Tennessee. Dylan, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I just had a few things to say. The police state is getting to the point where every single police force is militarizing. They're teaching everyone, you know, as much force tactics to take down individuals, and it's getting to the point where, I mean, we've got cameras in the squad cars, but now you can see through videos that officers know where the cameras are. They intentionally take suspects out of camera range. They do it on the cars. They do it in prison systems, and it's getting to the point where we've got to have more accountability. We've got to have a little bit more surveillance for our officers. And, you know, the fact that we've got a lot of officers that commit crimes and then they get put on unpaid leave for 2 weeks. You know, they get put on a desk job and then it's business as usual. Everything dies down and they go back to work.
Dylan, I appreciate your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about American police and deadly force in Ferguson, Missouri, in the New York chokehold case, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and beyond. We're asking, what is going on here? New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton was big on the broken windows policy. That is, keep order and crime will go down. That's come under attack now. People saying police too heavy-handed in their keeping order. Here he was last week, Commissioner Bratton, talking with CBS this morning, defending the use of his broken windows policy in preventing crime.
We are not targeting communities of color. We are targeting behavior. And the behavior is things that are prohibited by law, breaking the law. And make no mistake about it, this city is one of the safest cities in the world today because of that targeting of not only minor crimes, but serious crimes back in the 1990s. Serious crime is down dramatically.
But in Ferguson, Missouri right now, they're looking at 18-year-old Michael Brown dead and saying, why? The attorney who represented the family of Trayvon Martin has come in. Benjamin Crump, he said that the pattern of the cases he's working on is upsetting.
People are just frustrated. They're devastated. They are devastated that this happens again and again and is swept under the rug again and again. Not this time.
We've got Stephen Zeidman with us, director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at the CUNY City University New York School of Law. He's been writing about the broken windows policy, saying it's gone too far. For another couple of minutes, we've got Daniel Isom, former St. Louis Chief of Police, with us, now at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Carmen's calling from Stanton, Virginia. Carmen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. My question or comment is, I feel if all this, with all these crimes going on against, you know, young black males and just maybe the general public, why does it seem that police officers are shooting to kill rather than shooting to disarm or trying to de-escalate the situation? I know they have to protect themselves, but I feel they're just shooting to kill when they empty their rounds into victims or, you know, several officers, unload their guns. So I'm not familiar with change in law enforcement policies, but I was just wondering, you know, why has it come from shoot to disarm and not using, like, tasers and then to shoot before it seems like they're shooting to kill?
Good question. And in Michael Brown's case, not even to disarm. He wasn't armed, as far as we know. Daniel Isom, what about it? There are a lot of cartridge casings on the ground we heard here earlier this hour. Multiple shots, more than a couple, we heard the St. Louis County Police Chief saying. You hear Carmen's question, why so much and why not shoot to disarm?
He's gone.
Daniel Isom, I think we may have lost Daniel Isom there for a second. Steve Zeidman, can you address the question?
Yeah, well, I think part of it goes to you have to consider what it is that the police are addressing. And you know, if you look at the video again, I know we're going to talk more about James Boyd, but you have six or seven officers involved. They all seem to be armed in one form or another.
This was the Albuquerque mentally ill man who they who was camping illegally and ended up dead.
Yeah, and you have everyone is with their guns, their rifles trained on him. With Eric Garner, there were a number of police officers involved. The idea that they're going to, you know, carefully, almost like the movies, aim for his knee or something, just seems, impossible, especially when they're all trained, to kill, frankly. And I don't mean literally trained. I mean their guns are trained right on him. The situation in Eric Garner, we're not talking about anyone firing a weapon, but the question is when a man says over and over, I can't breathe,
yeah,
you have to wonder what's going on in people's minds that they just don't stop. You know, and from my perspective, what that is, it's less about, believe it or not, I think, the individual officers and more what they're being told to do, the directive that comes from the top, this idea of maintaining order at all costs. You know, it's nice for the police commissioner in New York City to say there's this causal relationship between massive arrests for minor crimes and a decrease in crime, but there's no proof of that whatsoever. What we do have proof of is that what's happening is that certain communities and certain people who live in these communities, black and Latino communities, are in fact being criminalized. And it's going to create resentment. It's going to spill over into all sorts of situations like this where things get out of hand rather quickly.
Carmen, I appreciate your call. Bill in Elkhart, Illinois. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Hi.
My question was about the militarization of the police force. I drive into work every day. I work in the city, but I live way out in the country. And every day driving into work, I pass through this little town of about 2,000 people. And a couple of months ago, I noticed that they got themselves a Humvee. Now, what in God's green earth does a tiny little town of 2,000 people with maybe five police officers, it's a bedroom community, why do they need a Humvee? Why are we equipped? I mean, I understand there are in major areas, you have SWAT details that have special weapons and training, and they're necessary. But why are we equipping regular police officers with military gear? And does this not infuse them with a military attitude so that they, instead of looking at the populace as citizens, they begin to look at them as enemies?
Bill, I'm really glad you raised that. Some of the images out of the Ferguson protests and more in the last couple of days have been got a lot of people concerned about that. Way beyond Humvees, I mean, big military equipment here and heavily armored and armed police look like combat troops coming into town. We've talked on this show over the years with Andrew Exum, former U.S. Army officer, scholar of the Middle East. He's done a lot of thinking about American military operations abroad. And we couldn't help noticing him talking about all this. He was tweeting yesterday, Andrew Exum saying, but can we have a conversation about these police uniforms, these heavily armed police in the streets? He says it's fun to dress up like Marines, not police, until you look like an occupying force in your own damn country. Tweeting here, the militarization of law enforcement is counterproductive to domestic policing and needs to stop. Andrew Exum writing on Twitter again, if you want to be a soldier, join the army. If you want to police your fellow citizens, dress the part. Daniel Isom, I know we just have you for another minute. Is there a problem with militarization in equipment, in attitude, in uniforms creeping into our local police departments?
Well, I do think that local law enforcement really needs to think about how they train police officers and what skills that you need to be a police officer. We are very good at using force to control behavior. At least we think we are in the policing profession. But there needs to be a conversation about other skills that you need, community engagement, conflict resolution, those types of, and people probably don't like this term, but soft skills that you need to build relationships with a community to keep them strong and to keep them safe. And so I do think there needs to be a dialogue in our profession about what does that initial police academy training look like and what does ongoing training look like and what are the skills that you really need to be a police officer in a domestic setting.
Daniel Isom, former St. Louis chief of police and now professor in criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You've been terrific to join us, and we're very grateful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Steve Zeidman, stand by in New York. A couple calls right here. Tina in Lexington, Massachusetts. Tina, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I read a story a couple of weeks ago about this new open carry law in Georgia and how two men carrying weapons had confronted each other in a convenience store, both asking to see the permit of the other for open carry.
Yeah.
They ended up drawing their weapons on each other. The police arrived, and they talked them down and arrested the men. And it occurred to me that if either one of those men or both of those men were black, it would have ended up in a gunfight with the police. I don't think it would have had the same outcome.
It's not hard to imagine how your mind went to that alternative and to picture it quite clearly. Tina, let us hold that and get one more, if I may. Thank you for that observation. Elizabeth in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I'll make it quickly. What I'm hearing from the show so far is a lot of the focus on race, and I actually spent time living in North St. Louis in an all-African-American community, and I'm white.
Okay.
And during my time that I lived there, I was often harassed and pulled over by the police because they assumed that being in that neighborhood, I was either a prostitute or somebody looking for drugs. One of the times I was pulled over right in front of my house, and they wouldn't let me go in and made me prove that I knew my address. And it was pretty brutal. And what I've noticed, I've traveled around a lot, is that socioeconomic level and the police who patrol the low-income neighborhoods, they seem to be more brutal and stigmatizing of anybody who sets foot there. If you're there, you must be bad because no good person would ever go there. And I'll get off the air for you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you very much for that call. Steve Zeidman, how about it? The question of, you know, how deep is the race factor here? How deep is simple low-income life here? Inequality. If you're on the wrong side of the canyon, you're going to have police problems.
Sure. Absolutely true. I mean, you can look at it the other way. A lot of these crises that we see, these homicides, they just don't happen in, you know, in rich, well-off white neighborhoods. Similarly, even with something like broken windows policing, we don't see it being enforced in well-off white neighborhoods. So you can ride your bike on the sidewalk in certain neighborhoods, but you can't do it in others. You can drink a beer in public in certain neighborhoods, but you can't in others. And that's, you know, that is borne out by data, that's borne out by arrest numbers. And so, sure, it's the intersection of race and class, absolutely correct.
But we've got real tensions economically in this country, real high unemployment in many communities we've had. Tough to get a job. One can imagine, if you're a police officer, you're kind of confronting a bigger reality that you didn't make. It's this country's economy, and you're supposed to keep order in the midst of that. That can't be easy.
For sure. But you also have to think about the irony within that very point, Tom, because part of what's going on is if you're being told as a police officer that your job is less about solving crime or even preventing crime, but more it's about maintaining order in a community. Each time you make an arrest of someone, you criminalize them. And it doesn't matter how trivial it is. That person is still going to go through the process. They're going to have an arrest record generated. They're going to be fingerprinted. They're going to have a mugshot. And that very act, even in a trivial low-level offense, is going to make it that much harder for that person to get a job, to get better housing, to get education, et cetera, all the advantages that come from people who don't have arrest records.
Yeah.
So in many ways, you kind of recreate the cycle.
Things can compound in a bad way. Rodney in Monroe, Wisconsin. Rodney, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm okay. What do you think, Rodney?
I think that we need to look at it from another angle as well, is that, you know, I believe a lot of police officers nowadays, well, the horror stories going on about cops getting shot or stabbed or whatever, is that a lot of them are afraid. You know, they're afraid to go out on the road things escalate to this point because they don't know, you know, if that gun is fake or if it's just a real gun spray-painted orange at the end.
And we have a lot of guns in this country, so there's reason for them to be worried.
Yes, there's a big reason to be worried. You know, you can go to a thing and the guy says, okay, I've got a knife, I'm going to drop it now. Oh, but I have another knife in my back pocket. Now that officer is dead. You know, I think you need to address that as well, as that, you know, it's also hard for police officers. I mean, it's a scary job. You know, I don't know how they can, as much training as you can put somebody through, there's still that level of uncertainty and fear that's going to come with no matter how much training you have.
Rodney, it's a good and important point. We have to keep all these things in mind as we look at it, but we want to have good law enforcement even when there's fear in the air. But I take your point. Steve Zeidman, stand by. Dr. E. Fuller Torrey joins us right now from Bethesda, Maryland, founder of the Treatment Advocacy Center. He's a doctor specializing in schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. He's author of Justifiable Homicides by Law Enforcement Officers, What is the Role of Mental Illness? It was a big factor in Albuquerque and has been in a number of deaths and police encounters there, and is across the country as a very disproportionate a portion of those killed by police have mental health issues. Dr. Torrey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, my pleasure, and you're absolutely right. There's a significant mental illness part of this. We should not be surprised. We've emptied out our hospitals. There are today over 3 million people with severe mental illnesses who are in the community who at one time would have been hospitalized on it and who are not receiving any treatment at this point. You then have police who are put on as frontline. They're the frontline people who confront the mentally ill in the community.
Mm-hmm.
The police did not sign up for this job. They're not well trained for it. And as your last listener said, a lot of them are scared. We did a study that you just mentioned a year ago that showed that about half of these police-related shootings are related to people who are severely mentally ill and not being treated. And until we start to treat them, we're going to continue seeing these. So I think rather than blaming the police, I think the first level of blame goes to the state mental health authorities and the governor who have failed miserably to provide treatment for the people in the community.
Is there a solution once you're on the street, Dr. Torrey? Can police tell what they're up against? If some, you know, oh, this person has mental health issues, so let's go easy here? Or once they're not treated, it's just not going to work out well.
Well, it's not going to work out well. We've done a lot of training. We have what's called a CIT training that was started by the Memphis Police Department. Many police departments have used that, but it's still only a small number of the police who are trained. And you got to remember, police were signed up for this job not to take care of mentally ill people, but to take care of robbers and people who are stealing cars and things like that. So it's a very bad mix to have people who are not trained to do this job and then ask them to do a job that they're neither trained for nor want to do.
Steve Zeidman, how do we get proper policing and proper accountability? Ferguson's very focused on that right now in this very complex and fraught stew that police and citizens face?
Well, I think you have to start at really the context that we're putting police officers in. And I'm just going back for a second to the caller who was talking about police being afraid and fear. And obviously that's real. But the question is, what is the situations that we are putting police officers in? So in other words, are we asking police officers to enforce minor laws which are just going to aggravate and agitate people and really put everyone in a difficult situation? And even regarding James Boyd, you know, to the extent there was awareness that there was someone with some form of mental illness, who was dispatched? Who did we send out there to try and to talk to him?
In Albuquerque.
Is this something that, is this something we should be sending the police? Because surely they're not properly trained to do this, and we're putting them again in a position where they can't possibly succeed.
Accountability, is that required to turn around this what seems like a bad trend right now?
Without a doubt, yes, indeed. Right, and from the top down.
From the top down, we've got big issues on the mental health front, on the policing front, Ferguson. Still fraught over what happened with Michael Brown on Saturday. And many communities around the country wanting to get this right, the stakes are, well, they're life itself. And it matters getting it right. We're grateful to the two of you for being with us today to help look at this. Dr. E. Fuller Torrey in Bethesda, Maryland at the Treatment Advocacy Center. We take your point, sir. Mental health services or else you've got problems. And I thank you for joining us to raise it today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Steve Zeidman at the City University of New York School of Law, Director of Criminal Defense Clinic there. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.